This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to the Marvel Age Masterclass podcast with host Ben Morse. Episode 1, 1961 through 1962, with guest Russell Sellers.
Welcome to the historic first episode of Marvel Age Masterclass, a comics podcast unlike any other. Hello, I'm your host. My name is Ben Morse. I'm coming from you taped from my backyard in Las Vegas, Nevada, the entertainment capital of the world. Who am I? Well, right now I am a mild-mannered professor at UNLV. Been doing that for about 4 months now. But before that, for 13 years, I worked as a professional in the comic book industry. I spent 3 years as a staff writer at the late lamented Wizard magazine before moving on for a decade at the one and only Marvel Entertainment, where I served various roles, most recently editorial director of digital media. What is this podcast, you might ask? Well, if you haven't already, go elsewhere here on Place to Be Nation Pop and listen to the first episode of the Marvel Age podcast. The gang gets together and breaks down the years of 1961 and 1962 in Marvel history. I'm a fan. I heard the first episode and I said, you know what? I want to get in on this action. So what I'll be doing is every time a Marvel Age episode drops, you will also be getting a Marvel Age Masterclass featuring me talking to a special guest from the Marvel Age podcast or from elsewhere. And in this case, my inaugural historic first guest is none other than Russell Sellers.
Hey, I didn't realize that Chris Hardwick was here.
Hey, that's awesome.
Is that what I sound like?
No, we've got our own version of it now. It's like the whole like the Talking Dead show that everybody, sure, you know, gets in on. We initially wanted to have you on as a guest, but something about the whole 3-hour podcast thing just wasn't conducive.
I'll tell you something, man. I used to when I was at Marvel, we recorded a weekly show called This Week in Marvel. Yeah. I co-hosted it with my buddy Ryan Penagos. It's still ongoing now, still a great podcast. But we used to turn in 3 to 4 hour podcasts because we were literally reviewing every Marvel book that came out and then taking every tweet on Twitter that mentioned Marvel. And they were lengthy. And eventually it's got to the point where I was like, dude, we got to cut these down, because it's painful for me to record them. I can only imagine what it's like for people who listen to them. So I listened to the whole first 3.5 hours of Marvel Age. I thought it was fantastic. I was got me through quite a few commutes, a little walking the dog, and then some time to spare as well. But I thought you guys were great. You got something good going there. I'm not a 3-hour podcaster anymore. That's not my bag. Maybe once in a while. But I was going to come on an episode of Marvel Age, but I decided, you know what? Why come on an episode of Marvel Age when I can have my own Marvel Age, right?
You should have your own show, Ben. We've been saying it for a long time, and it's kind of apropos that you would have me on as your first guest, because as people may remember, on the Guide to Wolverine episode of Sellers Points, that was your very first appearance on the comic side of Place to Be Nation.
Yeah, man, it's been a long time coming. If you guys heard my initial announcement about this show with Nick Duke, I kind of talked about it, and I'll get into it a little bit here before we get down to brass tacks. But, you know, it was when I was working at Marvel, it was the type of thing where I was spending 12 hours a day mainlining comics. And don't get me wrong, comics are my passion. I love them. But the last thing I wanted to do when I came home was talk more comics. I had to do something else, had to fit something else into the day. So unfortunately, what that meant was, as much as I was a fan of all you guys and girls on Place to Be Nation Comics, the stars weren't aligned for me to get involved. But now I've switched jobs. I've got a little bit of perspective. I'm really diving into comics again as a fan, which is a beautiful thing. I'm getting to go to stores and, you know, pick things up and not necessarily know what's going to happen. The last the last thing I knew what was going to happen on was the movie Black Panther, because I worked on it a little bit before I left Marvel. But Infinity War was a complete surprise to me. So, you know, that's the kind of experience I'm having. But now I get to come on and, you know, talk about comics with people, which is something that I've always loved to do with professionals, with fans, with everything. It's great.
And your perspective is something that I think we're all going to welcome, because you have a unique perspective on the comics industry, having been directly in it for so long. And the rest of us, you know, we're kind of, you know, ancillary characters in all this. We're fans. We just sit on the outside and analyze the books, you know, armchair quarterback the whole thing. And that's what we do best. So it's nice to have somebody who really knows their stuff and can tell us, you know, what's what.
Right. Well, I will see about that. I think you guys know a lot more than you think. But, you know, as we progress with this this experiment, this adventure, we'll kind of figure it out. But you ready to start talking about some 1961, 1962 Marvel?
Man, absolutely. And I am curious to hear at what points we really pissed you off as we were getting into
it. At no points did you really piss me off. Definitely, I disagreed with you guys on some stuff.
Sure.
Here's the thing, Russell. Let's go after this right away.
All
right. I always, as a Marvel employee, was, you know, kind of a little defensive of Marvel. I'm as big a DC fan as anyone. I love the Flash. Has been my favorite character since I was a little kid, and I dressed up as Flash. I made my own costume. There weren't made Flash costumes back in the 80s. So I took a pair of red pajamas, a red swim cap, some paper, and some yellow pipe cleaners, and I was the Flash. So I love DC Comics. I got my job at Wizard because it would help that I was friends with Jeff Johns. So I've got an affinity for DC Comics, but spending 10 years at Marvel, I was always a bit of a reactionary, you know, defend sure. Marvel guy. If you're going to take sides, Marvel versus DC, I was a Marvel guy. And I always saw, you know, perhaps I'm painting in broad strokes unfairly here, but I always saw all the Place to Be Nation comics guys as DC guys. Because you guys, a lot of you are primarily DC fans.
You ain't wrong.
Yeah, and I often felt that Marvel got the short end of the stick when it came to Place to Be Nation. So I'm hoping, you know, I want to bring an even-handedness to it. Again, working at Marvel for 10 years, being a fan since I was a little kid, I came to appreciate the Marvel Universe, Marvel Comics, all the characters and creators, and exactly like what they mean to the comic book industry. It's a special place. Again, I think DC is great in its own regard, but to me, Marvel is, and always probably will be, the number one comics company. Just because of what they've done, what they've innovated, and that's some of the stuff we're going to talk about tonight.
Yeah, and just to put a little context to it, my favorite character of all time is still Spider-Man. Always,
there you go.
Always has been, always will be. Peter Parker is my dude. And
yep.
That was, you know, when I came back to comics in college, the very first thing that got me back into it was J. Michael Straczynski's Amazing Spider-Man run that he did with John Romita Jr.
Yeah,
my first exposure to both of them, actually, as a creative force, and I collected every bit of that run.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my jam, man.
All right. Well, good. We're going to talk about Spider-Man today.
Awesome.
That's one of the topics I want to bring up. But I want to start with the formative building blocks of the Marvel Universe, as it were, and that is the Fantastic Four.
Oh, boy.
Fantastic Four debuted back in 1961. You guys read, you have to guide me a little here, you read issue number one, issue number two, and then where did you go from there?
I'm trying to remember exactly myself, because it's been over a month since sat down and
you guys read one and two, because you read the debut issue, the issue with the Skrulls. You read Doctor Doom's debut.
Yes.
You read Submariner's first appearance, and then Submariner's return appearance. So a good chunk of classic Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Fantastic Four.
Absolutely, and that. As you guys will hear on the episode, that first issue was kind of a rough moment for me.
Yeah.
but it got way better as it went along, and I actually became much more a fan of, say, the Submariner as a villain for the Fantastic Four. than pretty much any of them. And even though I love Dr. Doom as a villain, Submariner actually hit with me more than any of them and continues to in my further readings.
I think there's something to the fact that, and you know, don't worry, fans of the Fantastic Four, we're going to praise Lee and Kirby, or at least I will at some point.
Of course.
But I think there's something to the fact that Stan Lee and Jack Kirby inherited Namor fully formed.
Yes.
From decades of comics that came before. They were getting their feet wet when it came to Fantastic Four. This was the
pun.
First true... Yeah. Yeah, pun. There was a pun. Oh, I didn't even mean it. It was terrible. But, you know, literally, they were creating something that had never been done before. And let's get into that for a second, then we'll circle back to Namor. What I want to talk about is when I first got exposed to Fantastic Four, in particular the Lee Kirby Fantastic Four, because when I was a kid, and you and I were kids at the same time, so yep. Did you grow up reading comics?
I did, but not anything of the classic era. What I was getting into
was the
tail end of the Claremont and Lee X-Men books, and the formative book for me was J.M. DeMatteis's run on Spectacular and Amazing Spider-Man.
Those
were the ones that kind of made me, and still to this day, maybe my favorite Spider-Man run of all time.
Right on. It's a great Spider-Man run, and I was the same. I was an X-Men kid. X-Men was my big entry-level drug. I love my favorite series of all time is New Warriors, written by Fabian Nicieza.
Yes.
75 classic issues. But I, as a kid, didn't care for the Fantastic Four. And I noticed you didn't mention them either.
No.
And I feel like if you were a kid in the 80s or the 90s, the Fantastic Four were at best the third coolest Marvel team. Because the X-Men were the coolest Marvel team. There's no question.
Sure. No, not at all.
The Avengers, despite the fact they had some lean years, they were still the big leagues. They were still what people aspired to. So the Avengers... they were a solid number two.
If not in story and concept.
Exactly. They didn't necessarily live up to their concept all the time back then. But the Fantastic Four was just this... it was uncool. It was this family of adventurers. It was an old guy with gray hair. It was, you know, his wife.
Sure.
And it was just like the last thing you want to read about as a kid is... a family of adventures. That was my thing when I was a little kid. I was like, the Fantastic Four are uncool. Yeah. I always thought Mr. Fantastic in particular was incredibly uncool. And I was just like, go ahead.
I said, to be fair, who doesn't like Ben Grimm and Johnny Storm though?
I know, that's true. They were visually appealing. They had cool powers. They had cool attitudes. So it's true. The Thing and Human Torch were always cool, but they were saddled with particularly Mr. Fantastic and the Invisible Woman, who I never dug it. And
it's one of those now, to me, rare relationships in comics that I just still have trouble caring very much about.
Well, I did transform because as my comics fandom matured, as I got older, I wanted to understand the history of comics more. And that was when, especially when I had access at Wizard and at Marvel to a vast library of comics. This was before Marvel Unlimited, but I had, you know, the physical Marvel library at my disposal. And the first thing I said to myself was, all right, so as a kid, thought the Fantastic Four was uncool. As I grew up, kind of liked them. I went back and read the John Byrne stuff, pretty good. Mark Waid and Mike Waringo, loved their run, thought it was exciting. Still didn't think the FF were cool, though. Never thought the FF were cool. But I was coming to understand more and more the importance they held in the history of comics. If you know what I mean. If you follow what I'm saying, is like, I'm like, they became the classic, you know, if you're talking wrestling or if you're talking comics, they became the classic case of, I don't like them, but I know I'm supposed to respect them.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I'm at with this reading that you were talking about. And to throw in which issues we read, it was 1, 2, 4, 5, and 9.
There you go. All right, cool. So we're pretty on track there.
Yeah.
But when I got the chance, like I was saying, I got the chance, I got the library, and I had a chance to actually go and read comics that, you know, I'd never had an opportunity to experience before, because where was I going to find 1960s Fantastic Four issues
that were intact, right?
Exactly, without breaking the bank. And, you know, Marvel Masterworks were hardcover and expensive. It was tough. And if I was buying Essentials, I was buying Essential X-Men. I didn't care about Fantastic Four. We established that.
I don't know how Kirby art would hold up as a black and white either. Like, because those Marvel Essentials strip away a good bit of the depth and context of his work.
It's true. But anyways, I went back, and the first two things I read were the Lee Kirby Fantastic Four run and the Ditko Spider-Man Into the Romita Spider-Man.
Yes, that's good.
And that's the formative stuff of the Marvel Universe. And what I came to appreciate was how much of the comics I loved came from Fantastic Four. And just give me a second with this. I came to understand, you know, books that I loved, like New Teen Titans, Wolfman and Perez, another one of my favorite books of all time. The X-Men. Even something like X-Force, which I got into. Before the Fantastic Four, and this is a point I made to you guys on Facebook, and I think it's important to underscore again, and it's something I don't think was sufficiently pushed on the first episode of Marvel Age, is how much Fantastic Four changed the game. And what I mean by that is you can't fully appreciate Silver Age Fantastic Four until you go back and read Silver Age Justice League of America. Because if you go back and read Silver Age Justice League of America, which was the big hit teen comic before Fantastic Four, and I have the reprints. I have the Crisis on Multiple Earths reprints. So I've read that Gardner Fox, Mike Sikowski, Justice League of America. And it is, I'm sure for the people reading it at the time, it was novel to see all these characters in one place working together. But man, that stuff was dull as dishwater, man. It was seven characters who each had the exact same voice. Superman sounded the same as Green Arrow, who sounded the same as Aquaman, who sounded the same as Batman. And they all got along, and they all smiled all the time, and they all took out the villains, and then they went and celebrated at the Hall of Justice. And there was no dramatic tension whatsoever. Oh, Flash to Fantastic Four. Flash to Fantastic Four. I'll give you a second.
Okay.
Flash to Fantastic Four, you actually have a book where, you know, you guys talked about why did Stan Lee write Fantastic Four. You know, there are a million stories. The golf outing with his uncle, or the golf outing that his uncle went on and found out about Justice League and wanted a team book. The fact that his wife told him to write a book that he would like. Or just the fact that Stan was going to quit comics and decided to write a book along the lines of what he wanted. And the fact that it was a team of characters that bickered with each other, that didn't get along, that had flaws. The Thing was a monster. Mr. Fantastic was a pompous, smart guy. Human Torch was a hot-headed kid, and Invisible Woman was treated terribly because it was the 1960s and she was a female character. We don't really get into that. But the fact is, these guys had flaws. They were human. They were not like Superman. They were not unrelatable. So when I finally came to appreciate Fantastic Four, especially that early stuff, the early stuff that we read, I saw how much comics, modern comics, are reflected by what they did. So, I mean, you don't have to like Fantastic Four. You don't have to like the characters. You don't even have to like the Lee Kirby stuff. But I think there is a certain reverence you have to have for how things were irrevocably different. I think I just butchered that word. they were different before and after Fantastic Four number one. Now, I'm sure you got a lot to say, so go ahead and
I was just going to say that I absolutely agree with you on the Gardner Fox Justice League and pretty much the whole of Silver Age DC Comics at the time. It is not my bag, baby. the Silver Age in general is not necessarily my bag either. Mostly because that's just not. Those are not my formative years of comics, and trying to go back and get into it now, I'm seeing it through that wholly different lens of I can really appreciate my modern comics now, even whenever there are times whenever I might be reading something that seems a little silly, I can now like fully compare it to what was happening in the Silver Age and think, you know what, comics are way more sophisticated now, so let's not, you know, be too hasty. And going back and reading the Silver Age stuff, you're absolutely right that the conflict between the characters, the Fantastic Four, they didn't get along. They don't in those Lee and Kirby issues, especially Ben Grimm is not written as Mama Grimm's blue-eyed boy, as it were, in this. That's not him. He's a real dick at times. So much so that it's almost impossible to actually like the character. They make him impossibly mean-spirited and borderline evil at times. So it's like,
I'll tell you, Russell, I wonder, and I wish I could go, you know, ask Stan. I'll go. I don't think I'm gonna give him a call this week. But you know, I would love to ask Stan, just like, how much of that was the story arc? How much of that was you guys figuring out Ben Grimm? How much was it that they didn't get him at first? Because I mean, look, the thing about the thing is that this is a guy who should be miserable. He went on this ride into outer space. All his friends got super cool superpowers. It was something he didn't want to do. He got bullied into doing it by his annoying best friend and his bitchy girlfriend. And basically was bullied into flying into space. And as a result, he became a fucking monster.
Yeah.
And his life is now terrible.
And there was a moment there where it looked like they might be trying to do this whole like love triangle thing with.
I think they absolutely were. I don't think there was any question.
And they abandoned it pretty quickly, though.
Right. Well, see, that's the thing. That's what I'm curious about. And if anyone out there, comics historians, anyone else has the answer to this, you know, hopefully someone's listening to this podcast.
Yeah.
I want to know, like, was proto Ben Grimm what Lee and Kirby intended, and then they eventually hit on his kind of winning personality? Or was it always a plan that he was going to start off as a jerk so he would have a more redemptive arc? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The fact that he became the thing we know and love today was because he was a more complex character. And I'm giving Lee and Kirby a lot of credit there. And well, if I'm going to give anyone credit, it'll be Stan Lee and Jack Kirby.
Sure.
But I'm giving them the credit of thinking that they wanted to start this guy out in a dark place and eventually tell the story of him becoming a hero. But they could just as easily have been trying to they were just throwing shit at the wall.
Yes.
And it wasn't necessarily sticking. I think either one of those theories is equally credible.
I would agree with that. Like, it's anybody's guess, really, to the mindset at the time. They might... Stan may not even remember himself. It's been, you know, a long time since they probably had such a discussion. but yeah, the whole thing with Ben's story arc kind of makes sense in that context. Not when you put it that way, like giving him that redemptive arc. But I've noticed just in my readings of Fantastic Four up until I'm reading the 1963 stuff now.
Sure.
And he's at
Spoiler alert.
Not to give anything away for the next day episode of Marvel Age, but
come on, man, we still want people to listen.
Absolutely, like I'm giving you no spoilers here, really, but just to say that things undergo a bit of a change, I think is fairly accurate to say. And it doesn't take long because, like you said, Stan and Jack were getting their feet up under them with these characters and figuring out what their directions were going to be. And there is a pretty big shift in both the tone of the characters and the way that they interact with each other from one year to the next, almost in the exact same way that if you go back and read that first issue of Fantastic Four, I'm sorry, but that's not Kirby on his A-game. That art is kind of
You guys said that over... Yeah, that was the point you guys made over and over again. And I think you guys hit on some good points when you were discussing Kirby's artwork. I think the fact that he wasn't sure if this book was going to be a hit.
That's the way to add a little. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was saying it gets so much better. And then whenever you see Kirby on other books, it's like, okay, wow, he was into this immediately, and it comes through in the work.
I mean, just to add what little context I have, just from, you know, having spoken with people like Peter Sanderson and Tom Brevoort, who really know this thousands of times better than I ever will. Kirby, he was never a superhero guy.
Yeah.
He didn't like drawing superheroes. And that was what this book, even though they didn't have costumes at first, that's what it was supposed to be. It was supposed to be a superhero book. Kirby was having the time of his life drawing monsters and westerns and even romance. He loved drawing other stuff like that. And if you look at the stuff he eventually did when he was allowed to do whatever he wants, like when Kirby is creating freely, and just doing the things that most excite him, and you get stuff like New Gods, and you get stuff like Devil Dinosaur, you get stuff like The Demon, you get stuff like Machine Man, Eternals. You can see that Kirby was not a guy who wanted to draw a traditional superhero book. And I think that's early on what Fantastic Four was meant to be. It was meant to be a new take. Granted, they're doing something different. They're bickering. They're flawed characters, and they're not wearing costumes. But it's still supposed to be Marvel's version of the superheroes in the Silver Age. And I don't think that's what Jack was interested in drawing at first. I think what happened is the book became a hit, and he had to up his game. And if you guys were years away in this podcast from getting to some of the really incredible, like when we get to the Galactus trilogy and stuff that, it's Kirby at the height of his powers. And that's also a Kirby who has been drawing these characters for 50 issues and who's been able to create. But Kirby's at his best when he can create, when he can just go nuts and draw whatever he wants. So I think, you know, I don't want to say it was constrictive to at him on Fantastic Four at first, but I think as the book became more successful and as he and Stan got a looser leash, a longer rope, to do the things they wanted to do instead of just creating Marvel's answer to Justice League, I think you see Kirby improve dramatically.
Absolutely, and it's not just on Fantastic Four. It's on several books where he actually comes out the gate swinging on one in particular that just hit with me immediately. That was Journey into Mystery 83.
Well, let's transition over to that, because that's another book you guys read. So let's talk about... Have we spent enough time on Fantastic Four? I feel like I just...
I feel like we have. I feel like we've gotten...
I feel like I literally just said more about the Fantastic Four than I've ever said in my life. But it's all good. I'm sure we'll be talking about them more in future episodes. Thanks for bearing with me as I had kind of a long soliloquy. But I do, you know, just before we exit, I do feel strongly that, again, regardless of whether Fantastic Four are my favorite characters, and they're not. I really like Human Torch. I always have the Thing. Who doesn't love the Thing?
Right.
I have always said, this is something I always said, and I couldn't say it at Marvel because I couldn't really like diss our characters, but I always said, I go, Reed Richards is no one's favorite character. There's no kid out there who's like, I want to be Reed Richards when I grew up. And I was talked to by the likes of Mark Waid and Jonathan Hickman, who love Reed Richards.
Oh, God.
And I said to them, I said, I don't care, Mark, when you were 10 years old, I don't buy that you were a Mr. Fantastic fan.
No way.
Maybe you are now. I can appreciate Reed Richards more as an adult, too. He's a complex, interesting character. But there's no way, as a kid who just got into comics because they were cool, that I was like, this guy is cool.
Now, if Mark Waid tried to make that case, I'd look right at him and be like, tell me that you were a bigger fan of Reed Richards than you were of Superman at 10 years old. Tell me that with a straight face and convincingly.
I would challenge it. But Mark Waid's actually very scary, so Russell, don't do that.
No.
Don't confront.
I don't want to get blocked on Twitter again.
No, if you... Don't confront Mark Waid at a convention about Reed Richards, okay?
No,
no need for that.
The only thing I would want to do if I ran into Mark Waid at a convention is to probably beg him to sign my copy of Daredevil number one.
There you go. So we all love Mark Waid. Yes. I was the other day, I was ending the class. There's this kid in one of my classes, Jacob Brothers. I'll give a shout out to him if he's listening. Huge Flash fan. Loves the TV show. Awesome. Loves the comics. Just like me, Flash is my favorite character. So I just say to him, I'm like, since you're the same age as me, I'll see if you find this as sad as I did. I said, so who do you think is the best Flash writer of all time, Mark Waid or Geoff Johns? Because to me, those are the two choices.
Absolutely.
That like begins and ends with that discussion. And he goes, I don't know, man. What about Francis Manapul? And I just was like, I like Francis Manapul. He's so talented. But come on.
I'm sorry, dude. The Manapul and Buccellato run on Flash was good.
It was a fun run, but it's not up to the levels of those other guys. And I don't think Francis Manapul himself would think it's
now,
up to artistic, that
artistically speaking, it's maybe my Gorgeous. favorite looking Flash run of all time.
That's fair.
But when it comes to story, I'm sorry, Geoff Johns wins the race.
Yeah, absolutely. No question. Well, maybe a question, because I liked Waid's run a lot, too.
I'm actually just now reading Mark Waid's run on The Flash for the first time.
Oh, my God. You're in for something so good, man.
Those new collections, man, they got me hooked, and I love the way he writes Wally.
As much as I love what Geoff did on The Flash, I don't know that he could have done it without what Mark Waid did on The Flash.
Definitely not.
You know? But that's, you know what? We're veering down into a Flash podcast that we're going to have to.
It could happen.
You and me are going to have to get together on that down the line, I think. But we got to keep talking Marvel for a little while. So Journey into Mystery, you dug it.
Absolutely.
It seemed like all you guys dug it. Talk to me a little bit about why Journey into Mystery worked for you in a way that some of the other books maybe didn't necessarily hit.
I think it was because, as Nick points out correctly on the show, that a lot of these characters, when you're reading them for the first time, they don't feel fully formed. They don't feel like the characters that you recognize. But Thor, from the outset, felt like a version of the character that we all recognized. Sure, he's always in that Donald Blake persona, even when he's transformed into Thor. But as it goes along, he's doing all the Thor things that we know and love about the character. He's like slinging the hammer. He's taking on these random evil space aliens that, you know, just randomly show up. And I don't think we see them again for a little while. But
Stone Men from Saturn?
Yes. They're kind of inconsequential as villains.
100%. 100% inconsequential.
But just as an intro, it was like, man, this feels like a book that a character that was fully formed, fully realized, and something that Kirby really sank his teeth into in the artwork, because from the outset, it's like, wow, this book looks damn good. And it moves at such a brisk pace, too. It was one of those that was like, man, I'm just burning through this so fast. And it actually left me wanting more of it. So this, if any book in this list outside of maybe Amazing Fantasy 15 was gonna like really grab me, it was Journey into Mystery 83, and then I think actually 85 might have been superior to it, because that was our first introduction of Loki.
And he's great from the jump. Kind of expanding on what I was talking about, what we were talking about when we were discussing Fantastic Four and Kirby kind of being forced to, not being forced, but, you know, being made to draw stuff he wasn't particularly excited about. I think the 180 from that is Journey into Mystery and Thor. This was the stuff that Jack Kirby, I mean, again, Kirby created Captain America, Golden Age of Comics, created the Newsboy Legion, the Guardians, the Challengers of the Unknown, prolific monster artist. Marvel did a whole event while I was there, based strictly on Kirby monsters, Monsters Unleashed. And he drew everything, but the thing you gotta understand about Kirby is that he always wanted to do mythology. That was his love. That was his passion.
You could tell.
And Yeah, and as a kid who, before I read comics, I read Greek mythology. That was kind of like my bridge. So to me, like, you know, like Hercules and Zeus and all those characters, they were the forebears to Superman and Spider-Man and all that.
Absolutely.
So I think Kirby, from what we know about him, I think was a lot in the same vein. A thing about Kirby that I think gets misunderstood, and I was actually talking to a fellow professor and comics fan about this the other day, is there's kind of this narrative of Kirby as almost as Ben Grimm, like the street tough, you know, blue collar guy. And he was all those things, you know?
Yeah.
He was blue collar, he was street tough, he did know his stuff. But the thing I think gets lost in there is this guy was highly intelligent and very cultured. To create the things that he created, you can't just have, you know, a high school diploma and not understand how to read. Like, this is a guy who clearly understood mythology, who clearly understood science fiction, because that's the beauty of Thor, and that's the beauty of Journey into Mystery, is that it's the marriage of mythology with science fiction. And I think... Go ahead.
I think that that's hitting the nail on the head, and it's also one of the things that I truly appreciate about at least a few of these early Marvel issues, is that it's marrying these two genres together, the sci-fi fantasy
Absolutely.
Genre, which I mean, it's not like it was the first time it had ever happened, I don't think, but the way Kirby does it, you can absolutely tell that this guy has read a lot of mythology, and he knows his Norse mythology, which
absolutely
like nobody probably knew that at the time.
a little more obscure. It wasn't exactly as mainstream and popular as Greek Roman mythology. The Norse stuff was a little. I mean, honestly, Kirby and Lee probably popularized it. To be frank,
I think so. I think that is absolutely correct. That there wouldn't be any interest in Norse mythology today. Yeah. I don't think if it hadn't been for what these guys did in the Journey into Mystery series, and
it's a scorching hot take.
I really don't think that there would be as much interest in it. And
stand
I think,
by it. There you go, man.
And I also think that we're about to see a real uptick in it after Infinity War, because let's face it, folks, Thor wrecked shop.
Thor's the star of Infinity War.
Yeah, he
absolutely, 100%. This is my take on Infinity War, real quick, because guys, if you're listening to this podcast, something you need to know is that we're going to talk about Marvel Age, but obviously we're going to go off into tangents. That's just, it's unavoidable. When you talk about comics, you go off into tangents. Real quick on Infinity War, loved it, thought it was incredible. Eventually, I'm having Tim Capel on the show, so perhaps we'll have a discussion about it. But
prepare yourself now.
Yeah, I'm stealing myself for it. I need to have him on later on so I can really... gird up my arguments. But I thought about Infinity War, and this is what I've told anyone who will listen. In terms of the big three, I think Iron Man does okay. Captain America, I think, is given some of the coolest stuff to do and consistently makes it boring. And then I think, conversely, Thor is given some of the most ridiculous scenes and makes them awesome. And of course, when I say Thor and Captain America, I'm talking about Chris Evans and Chris Hemsworth. All due respect to both men, who are absolutely. Both brilliant actors, but I think Hemsworth blows them away in this one.
Yeah, Hemsworth is star of the show for me. Tony gets a moment to remind all the detractors he picked up in Civil War that he is the fucking hero of this of this universe.
This whole thing, whole universe.
Because you go hand to hand with Thanos when your armor's breaking down and you still keep fighting.
Yeah, when he shines, he shines.
Hero. So don't anybody ever forget it. And I will say, though, Captain America, underserved in the movie. Needed some more screen time. But, hey, we still got another Avengers movie to go. He's going to get another minute shine.
We'll see if Cap can shine there. I will say the only the only two guys who compared to Hemsworth. I'll give a threefer. I'll say from the Guardians, Zoe Saldana, because she knew she was going out.
Yeah.
Give performance of a lifetime. Chris Pratt could
Loved
more
him.
Than hold his own.
Loved him.
And let's be honest, man. Dave Bautista.
Good just God, yes.
Just brilliant. Good Lord. And Bradley Cooper, too.
Yeah, I want to say shouts to Rocket and Bradley Cooper's performance.
Yeah.
It was really good.
And the Guardians may have been the best part of Infinity War.
They were. And
them along with Thor.
And Thanos was done really well.
And Thanos and Black Panther. Spider-Man.
My favorite villain in the movie was Ebony Maw.
He was good.
I loved that.
Underserved. All right, so guys, that's for those of you keeping track, the podcast we now owe you are the Flash podcast and the reaction to the Infinity War reaction show. But
we got shows to record.
We got some work to do. But jumping back to Thor and kind of putting a bow on him, I think we talked about how much Jack loved it, how much Jack loved mythology, how much he got into this. Mm-hmm. Let's not leave out the fact that I think this was something Stan wanted to do as well. The language. I mean, you get caught up in like cosmic Kirby and the power of his art and his character designs and how Asgard looks and all that. It's hard to look past it. It's beautiful stuff, especially in full color. Like you said, I don't think it would have as much impact black and white. The way these guys talk, especially once you didn't get to it in the first episode. Because Thor's still talking like Donald Blake.
Yeah.
But once Stan really lets loose on these Shakespearean soliloquies that the Asgardians are spouting out, I mean, and he would do it again later with the Silver Surfer, who, for those who don't know, the Silver Surfer is Stan Lee's favorite character that he's ever created. That's on the record, I believe. But Thor was where he really cut his teeth on that stuff. And I think to make the fine point is that if Fantastic Four was the book that Lee and Kirby had to do to start the Marvel Universe, I think the success of Fantastic Four allowed them to do the book they wanted to do, which was Journey into Mystery.
And that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, Journey into Mystery had been around for a long time. It's issue 83 when Thor is finally introduced.
Yeah, it was a monster book for years.
Yeah, it was one of those anthology titles that that was around. Like Amazing Adult Fantasy number 7 was also on our reading list.
Yes.
Even though it has nothing to do with any superhero whatsoever. It is an anthology title that is very Twilight Zone.
You guys mentioned that.
And I actually really dug it.
I did not read all the issues. I know most of this stuff from memory. Yeah. Like I know the Fantastic Four.
I don't even know why it was on the reading list, because the whole list that we're following from Comic Book Herald is focused on the development of Marvel superheroes.
The Marvel Universe.
So Amazing Adult Fantasy being in number 7 being in there at all, I don't get
it. Interesting.
But
it may have been his thing just to say like, hey, here's what was out there.
Yeah,
and just kind of give you like a barometer.
I do recommend, like, some folks may dig it, you know, most of our panel did not, but I thought I was entertained. So, you know, you check that out or you don't, it's whatever. But that leads directly into a little bit later, I think the true like coup de grace of this whole reading list this first year, Amazing Fantasy 15.
Oh, we're gonna. I like that you call it the coup de grace, because that's gonna be our big finish.
I got you.
We're gonna build to that,
because we got two books on this list that just absolutely sucked.
That's what we got to get through now, and I think let's address the literal elephant in the room. So if Fantastic Four was the book that they had to do and the book that started the Marvel Universe, if Thor was the book they wanted to do where they really got to shine, I think Hulk was the book where they took a shot and it just missed the boat, man. Early Hulk is not good stuff. And you guys rightly criticized it, I feel like. You spin a little on the Hulk, and then I'm going to give my piece on it as well.
It's poorly drawn. It's poorly written. The concept is fine. The concept is actually kind of works, but this is not the Hulk that you know from the modern era at all. He transforms at night. It has nothing to do with him being angry. He's a gray, semi-smart Hulk. It reads more like a Jekyll and Hyde ripoff than it reads like any kind of superheroics. It's there's some vague like homosexual innuendo in there as well that just feels really kind of ham-fisted and off, just kind of off-kilter with Rick Jones. Some not well thought out plot points either. I think I call that out on the episode in far more detail, but this is not a good book. I don't see how, even in the context of the time, that someone would have picked this up and said, oh man, I got to get more of this. Especially not whenever you got far superior books to it, like Fantastic Four or like Journey into Mystery, running at the same time. So kids, if you're going to go spend your nickel on a comic book, maybe not that one.
So here's what I'm going to say. First, in defense of the Hulk. What I'll say in defense of the Hulk is that history has proven these guys right in some sense.
Yes.
In some sense, it hasn't, because like you said, the Hulk we meet in Hulk number one in 1962 bears little resemblance to the Hulk that would eventually become one of the most popular characters in comics. But at the same time, the Hulk did eventually become one of the most popular characters in comics. And I think the barest of details were laid down in these early issues. There's something. They got the Hulk's DNA so that other writers and artists would later give it a take on it. When you guys do 63, and whoever I'm going to discuss 63 with, we're going to talk, and as we move on through this experiment, we're going to get into the X-Men,
yes,
who were another... I'm not going to judge it, but I'm going to go back and reread it like you guys are. I'm not going to say that the early X-Men stuff was missed, because it has some merits to it, but more than anything with X-Men, with early Uncanny X-Men, which wasn't originally called Uncanny X-Men, fun fact, is that at Marvel, the 1963 book, which was originally just X-Men, and eventually came to be known as Uncanny X-Men, I think around like issue 93 or 94. So I don't think it officially became Uncanny X-Men until Days of Future Past.
Oh, wow.
But at Marvel Entertainment, that book is known revisionist history from the start as Uncanny X-Men, just to help distinguish it from the 91 series.
Yeah.
So just a little inside the house of ideas fact for you guys, that you will like X-Men number one from 1963, if it's ever referenced in Marvel, is always referenced as Uncanny X-Men number one. Anyways, neither here nor there. The point being that the X-Men had the core of something special, with the metaphor for racial inequality, with Xavier and Magneto as the Martin Luther King and Malcolm X figures,
yes,
and a lot of the other stuff that guys like Claremont, Cockrum, Byrne, Lee, Silvestri, etc., and later on Morrison, Whedon, etc., would mine into and do something really special with. Like, they, you know, they got that from basically a failed Lee Kirby vehicle. They took what was cool about this failed comic, and they used it to make it perhaps maybe Marvel's crown jewel for many years. So I'm going to say that I think something about the Hulk, something about the idea, because you mentioned, you name checked Jekyll and Hyde. And
yeah,
look, there's no question. This is a Jekyll and Hyde ripoff. I think Stan, you know, wanted to do his take on Jekyll and Hyde. I don't think there's any question. Yeah, and I'm not trying to diss Stan there. I think you know, Stan was writing 85 books a month. He had to get his ideas from somewhere.
Right.
He couldn't come up with all of them originally, but it was his take on Jekyll and Hyde, which I do think eventually became a bedrock of the Hulk character. He is about duality. He's about, you know, what does anger do to a man? What happens when your id runs unchecked? But other than that, I don't think in the original Hulk stories, I think Stan took a stab at something and didn't really get into it. This was not what he was meant to write. And Kirby, it's a little more disappointing with Kirby because, well, number one, I think, you know, anytime Kirby doesn't deliver, we're disappointed because it's Kirby and he's, you know, the king of comics. But for me, it's kind of crazy that Kirby's Hulk wasn't better simply because, as we established, he was the premier monster artist for so long that this should have been right in his wheelhouse. And I don't know if he was maybe sick of drawing monsters at this point, but it's a little, it's a black mark on both guys' records that the original Hulk didn't take off. But I will give them credit that there was something in the chemical equation of the Hulk, you know, all the supporting characters and the basic concept and the idea of this monster who's ostracized by society. It did eventually lead to something great in other hands.
It really did. And I mean, shouts to that Bill Bixby TV show, because that in my Absolutely. Mind was kind of like how I always envisioned Hulk.
Right.
And the way he's portrayed in the modern films runs like, and I, even though it's very different from that, I'll give the Greg Pak run on Incredible Hulk a lot of credit, because I really enjoyed Planet Hulk and World War Hulk at the times that I read them. So, plenty of good stuff to come from Hulk.
It's just, you can't talk about Hulk without mentioning Peter David.
Oh, absolutely not. And it's one of those concepts, I think, that you're right, the DNA for it was there, but maybe don't take the cake out of the oven before it's actually crusted over.
Absolutely, man. Because
I want to eat cake, not, you know, have soup.
Right. I don't want to get salmonella from reading the first six issues of the Hulk. 100% understand. So the other miss for you guys, if I recall correctly, was the introduction of Hank Pym in Tales to Astonish.
Yep, Tales to Astonish number 35. And where the Hulk was just an idea that didn't cook long enough but still had a lot of interesting stuff going on, Tales to Astonish number 35 is one of the most boring comics I have ever read in my life. You want to talk about verbose and a slow as molasses plot. It rolls out at such a mundane speed that I'm like, is this really a superhero story? And then the concept of it, I invented gases that I inhale and they like shrink me or grow me. I was like, if that wasn't a drug metaphor, I don't know what is. But but at the same, it's how did a drug metaphor turn into this boring slog? I don't get it. I don't understand it. Hank Pym has no personality. He's boring as shit. And the whole idea, I'm gonna shrink down and I talk to ants. Buddy, you are already, you know, fighting an uphill battle with that concept, and then you throw in boring characters to boot. I'm sorry, but this was one that I eventually had to start like really speed reading and skimming through it to get there, because I was like, "Oh my God, is it ever going to be over?" I'll say this: maybe my opinion on that softens later, maybe it doesn't. But for right now, I hated it.
We'll see once he gets his costume, once he gets some villains, and once the Wasp comes in, what happens. But I think we filed this one under the can't all be winners. And I think something that's interesting is so much, and I want to get your take on this, Russell, is that so much of the success of Marvel Studios has come from their willingness to pay homage to the source material, that in particular, look at something like Guardians of the Galaxy. The Guardians are very much the Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning Guardians, you know, with the sense of humor, with the underdog mentality and all the stuff that made them great. Uh-huh. And, you know, the big classic characters, Captain America, Thor, Iron Man, in a lot of cases, they work, again, because of brilliant performances by actors like Robert Downey Jr., Chris Evans and Chris Hemsworth, but also because the Marvel Studios understands what has made these characters work for decades and what has continued to make them viable.
Yes.
On the flip side, I think Marvel Studios figured out Hank Pym for the first time I think literally decades of comics writers, and some of the very best comics writers, have tried to, again, do what what was done with the Hulk and the X-Men, taking a discarded, unsuccessful Stan Lee concept in Hank Pym and making him work. I don't think, you know, here's my hot take of the evening. I don't think any comics writer has ever truly made Hank Pym work. And I count some of the most talented comics writers of all time right up there with Dan Slott, Mark Waid. You know, a lot of guys who have told me they had an idea for Hank Pym, and I don't think he's ever worked as well as he did as portrayed by Michael Douglas in the Ant-Man movie. Well, I think that's the best Hank Pym we've ever gotten. And I think it's the most fully realized Hank Pym we've ever gotten.
I'm absolutely on board with that because they told Michael Douglas to just play Michael Douglas. And
yep.
That's, and that's why it worked so well, because they weren't going
to
tell him, hey, dude, you know this character, Hank Pym? Yeah, the one who likes to like beat his wife and stuff? Yeah, go play that. No. Sometimes bringing the comic book version of the character to the screen is not the best idea. And I'm going to say, let's not do that. And just have Michael Douglas play himself and call him Hank Pym. And you know what? It works.
Yeah, and he's awesome.
Because this, so far, the comic book version of Hank Pym, not doing it for me.
Yeah. So we'll come back to Hank Pym in future episodes. Like I said, let's give it a shot, because I've never read classic Ant-Man stories either. So let's together agree that we're going to see what happens with Hank Pym.
I guess.
Spoiler alert, I don't think anything good's coming of it. We know there are eventually good Hulk stories and good X-Men stories, but yeah, Hank Pym, we'll see.
Hard to imagine.
Yeah. So let's get to, like you said, kind of
the
capstone of this. The issue that you named this as your favorite issue of all the ones you read, correct?
Yep.
Let's talk about if Fantastic Four revolutionized comics, I think Spider-Man in the pages of the Amazing Fantasy is not far behind. I think Spider-Man was another, like, look, Thor was really good, but Fantastic Four and particularly Spider-Man were game changers.
Yes.
Comics, you can demark comics that came out before Spider-Man and comics that came out after Spider-Man. He was so different from, number one, any, just like the typical superhero, Superman, Batman, Flash, Green Lantern, Captain America, Namor, Human Torch, all these guys, even the most complex ones, which would probably be Namor and the Torch, were not nearly as complex and nuanced as Peter Parker. And beyond that, beyond revolutionizing the superhero genre, this was a very bold take. And I think this is the same way I tried to put Fantastic Four into context against Justice League. Huh. I'll put Spider-Man into context against Robin, Speedy, Aqualad, Kid Flash, these personality devoid kids who were designed to get young people invested in comics, but acted like no teenager you would ever meet in real life. Spider-Man was a daring take on a teenage character, but not only that, he was the first teenage character to headline his own book. He was not a sidekick. He was not a co-star. He was the star of his story.
Yep.
And I think I'm probably with you. I think Amazing Fantasy, the introduction and origin of Spider-Man, is the crown jewel of this particular list of 10. And I come at it from a different perspective than you did, and I want to get into that, but I just talked a lot, so yeah. I want to let you talk, and then I'll come back and talk some more.
Well, as I say on the Marvel Age podcast, this is one of the most interesting origin stories of its era, mainly because if you read it in the context of, say, the modern comics context, this story comes off not as an origin for a hero, but the origin of a villain.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely.
It's not until you get to the final twist of the book that Peter Parker goes the other way. Mm-hmm. And makes that decision. But for the first time in all of these books where it was almost like, oh, they make the right decision because of they, of course they have to because they're the heroes of these books. With Amazing Fantasy 15, despite me knowing how this ends, I was still wondering, like, my God, what would it be like if he went the other way? Because he could easily do it. It felt like there was an actual choice to be made.
Sure.
And when you get into the emotional stakes of it, to which they are great in this issue, helped along by the tremendous Steve Ditko art. His facial expressions alone are just mind-boggling for the time.
They were ahead of their time.
Ditko
was ahead of his time. He was doing things with his work that would become commonplace 20 to 30 years later.
He's the man. I mean, we give it to we gave it to Kirby as the artist of the year because of just the sheer amount of work that he did.
Dude, the stuff Kirby was cranking out and that it was the quality it was is remarkable.
Exactly.
But if Ditko on the one or two books he was doing really brought it.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I came so close to saying Ditko was my artist pick of the year, and I kind of changed my mind at the last second. But, man, Amazing Fantasy 15, I'm not really talking so much about any of the other stories in the book, but that Spider-Man story is one
we don't have to get into the other stories.
We're not going to. Yeah. But
sorry if you guys were waiting this whole hour to hear about the backup stories in Amazing Fantasy, we will not be cut.
Negative. But yes, the fully formed version of Peter Parker is present in this book. You see who he is, what he's about, why he thinks the way he does, why he feels the way he does. And that is tremendous for an origin issue in an anthology book.
How many pages is it? It's under 20, I know that.
Yeah, it's like 20. Like 22 pages total for the book. But you've got the Spider-Man origin sitting at around maybe half the book.
Yeah.
And
so that's remarkable.
It is a tremendous testament of storytelling. And this was the moment, I think, that the light bulb really had to have gone on for Stan when he hit on this idea. Like, oh my God, this has got to be the one, and we got to do this. And it's one that, I don't know how to describe it other than just to say, this is immediately the Spider-Man you know and love from the jump, and you can see the influence that this book has on so many other titles going forward. This was the book, I think, that probably got DC's attention maybe more so than any of the others. It had to have. They had to have looked over at this and said, whoa, what did he do?
It was a shot across the bow, man. They were doing something so completely different. I mean, historically,
I think it was putting a hole in the side of their ship.
Yeah.
It wasn't across the bow. It was a damn.
It was a shot. It was doing serious damage. But historically, so the read on Fantastic Four has always been that was Stan and Jack trying to do an answer to Justice League, but also doing the kind of book they want, or that Stan at least wanted to do, basically what he thought was missing from superheroes. The take on Spider-Man, and I've heard Stan tell this story himself, is that Stan hated teen superheroes. He had a great hatred for them. He hated these smiling, just jumping around in their skimpy costumes, innocent. Like, even the fact that he wrote Bucky stories, he hated Bucky. And that's why you noticed the fact that when he brings back Captain America in the pages of Avengers, he makes sure to kill off Bucky. That was deliberate. That was something said. And actually, funny story, a quick aside. When I was at Wizard, I had the good fortune to interview Joe Simon, the co-creator of Captain America. And Joe had not really been, I mean, he was a Golden Age comics creator, but he had gone on to do other things. He was not necessarily tuned in to comics beyond the Golden Age that he wrote in. So I was talking to Joe Simon, and this was in, what year did Captain America die in?
God, I don't even remember.
I want to say 06. I want to say something like 2006.
Yeah, it had to have been around then because I bought bought two copies of that book.
Right, because that was good. I'm sure that's going to put your kids through college.
Sure, right.
But anyways, so it's 2006. I'm interviewing Joe Simon, and I'm talking to him about Captain America, and I'm saying, oh, by the way, Bucky's back. Ed Brubaker brought back Bucky. Isn't that crazy? And Joe Simon just goes to me, what do you mean brought back? And I go, Joe, do you not know that Bucky was killed off in 1963? And he goes, no.
Uh-oh.
He goes, who was the writer who killed off Bucky? And I go, it was Stan Lee. He goes, Stan? The kid who used to work for me? And he was just like, I was like, oh, I hope I didn't upset you. He goes, no. He goes, that's the funniest thing I've ever heard. So he was just, yeah. So I was the one, if I got to do nothing else in my comic book career, I did a few things, which we'll probably touch on in this show. But one of them was I got to break the news to Joe Simon that Stan Lee killed off Bucky. So that was a great moment for me, personally.
That was like moment of career made. I got to break the bad news.
Absolutely. Joe Simon, what a sweetheart of a guy. Great guy, great creator. But, so anyways, Stan created Spider-Man out of a hatred for teen superheroes. He said, everything they do with teen superheroes over at DC and even at Marvel, I'm going to do the opposite. I'm going to make a kid who's not happy all the time. I'm going to make a kid who's not popular and, captain of the football team and smiling all the time. And I'm going to give him a full mask. I'm going to give him a full bodysuit. I'm going to make him creepy. I'm not going to give him, powers that are necessarily like wish fulfillment. Like, this is going to be almost like a borderline horror story in some ways. I mean, you look at Spider-Man, it's almost like this. Just the way Ditko draws him, especially, crawling around, so creepy. He's so sinister. He's not Superman bouncing off the page. He's not even Robin the Boy Wonder. And I think that's where Spider-Man came from. He was birthed from that very interesting place. And I think Stan succeeded in, like you said Stan really knew he had something here. I agree. I think Spider-Man was the one where he knew he had a hit. But at the same time, conventional wisdom would not have agreed, because this was doing something that had never been done before. This was doing a moody, nerdy teenage superhero who you couldn't see his face, and you couldn't relate to him, and you would not see him as your point of view character. And what was so interesting is that in creating this character who was so antithetical to the idea of the teen sidekick who everyone was supposed to see themselves as, Stan and Steve tapped into a teenage character that everyone, particularly people reading comics, actually did see themselves as. And they made the most relatable superhero of all time in Spider-Man.
And going back to like of the time in like 1961, 1962, I couldn't imagine trying to pitch that idea at DC at the time, or to pitch
I think it was hard enough to pitch it at Marvel.
Yeah, I think it was. I don't know if it was necessarily just a pitch, or he just said, "You know what? I'm just going to do it, and you guys are going to put it out there." And that's it. Just it.
I think there's something to that. I think there must have been a point where, off the success of Fantastic Four and some of the subsequent stories, I think Martin Goodman probably was allowing Stan a lot of latitude to do what he wants. I mean, he saw that Fantastic Four was so different and it was such a huge success that I think he said, kind of do your thing. I want to give my different take of how I came to Spider-Man, and we'll kind of wrap things up here.
Yeah.
My great shame as a nerd, I have two great shames. The number one, and they've both given me a lot of grief, working in comics over the years and being around other people who love comics and science fiction. The first big one was I didn't think Star Wars was great. I think it's fine. I think it's okay. And believe you me, Russell, if you tell a Star Wars fan that you hate Star Wars, they will have more respect for you than if you say it was just okay. They can at least respect the passion in the other direction. So I had a lot of people very angry at me over the years for the fact that I thought Star Wars was just kind of a decent little sci-fi movie.
Man, and you've hung out with Jason Aaron before, right?
I have. Yeah, we don't talk about Star Wars. But the other one was when I was a kid, I didn't like Spider-Man.
Oh.
I never got into Spider-Man, which is the opposite of your journey. Because, yes, you, like you said, Spider-Man, he was your guy. He was your entry level, particularly, and you were reading the same stuff that I was reading. The reasons I didn't like Spider-Man, well, there are two reasons. One was he was a science nerd, and I wasn't. So I was like, I can't relate to this guy. Like, he's, you know, I'm not getting picked on. And also, I'm not as smart as him. Like, he's a genius. Like, he has a genius-level intellect in terms of science. And then the other thing, on the flip side, was I was like, and he's married to a fucking supermodel. I was like, I can't relate to that. Like, I'm not puny Peter Parker of the 1960s getting picked on by Flash Thompson, but if, by the same token, I'm not Peter Parker who lands super hot Mary Jane. So I'm like, you know, either end of the spectrum, I just don't get it with Spider-Man. So I was like, whatever. I bought Spider-Man comics. I bought the same stuff you were buying, the J.M. Mattias stuff. I didn't appreciate it at the time as much as I should have. But I was just kind of checked out on Spider-Man. Yeah. It wasn't until years later, again, much in the same way I went back for Fantastic Four, that I went back for Spider-Man. And I read the Lee Ditko stuff. And immediately, with this issue of Amazing Fantasy that we're talking about, I got it. I understood why everyone said Peter Parker is the most relatable character out there. It had nothing to do with science. It had certainly nothing to do with supermodels. It had everything to do with, like you said, you nailed it perfectly. This was a guy who, by all rights, should have become a supervillain. Everything is working against him. He chooses to do the right thing, even though it's the hardest thing to do. And that makes him more of a hero than Superman, than Batman, than Flash, than all these characters. Because when Superman goes and saves Metropolis, everyone loves him. Batman's a more complex case. We can't really get into Batman. He's probably like the most Marvel of the DC characters. We'll address that on a separate show. But so many of these characters are revered by their cities. Flash has a fucking museum dedicated to him.
Yes.
You know, everyone loves Green Lantern. And even the Marvel characters, even the Fantastic Four, you know, the Thing's a monster, but the public loves him at this point. You know, they love the Fantastic Four.
The Fantastic Four, they love celebrities.
Yeah, they're celebrities. The Avengers are a big deal. Spider-Man, his uncle dies. He can't make any money. The kids at school hate him. Everything is terrible for this guy. He should be the most bitter, resentful prick on the planet. And when he gets superpowers, he should absolutely use them to do selfish things. But the problem is, he does. And when he does, that's when he loses the person he's closest to, and Uncle Ben. And that's the brilliance of the origin, is that when Spider-Man does the selfish thing, he loses. When he does the unselfish thing, he still loses.
Well, he still kind of loses, yeah.
Yeah, every time. But he doesn't win. He doesn't win, but he keeps going.
The difference is that he can look at himself in the mirror after he does the right thing, which is something he can't do by doing the wrong thing, because whenever he realizes it was his fault that Uncle Ben was dead, that's when it really hit home for him. And
yeah,
there are more moments I wish we could get into about mm-hmm. Amazing Spider-Man 1-3, which I just finished reading. And, oh, man, there's so much good stuff. It just keeps going.
It is. Spider-Man's another one that if they didn't – if the Hulk was a misfire, this was a direct hit. This was one where Stan knew what he was doing,
yeah,
and he just got it right. And you know, him and Ditko they killed it. So I don't know. There's much more to say. Like you'll get a chance to talk about, of course, the Amazing Spider-Man issues on the next episode of Marvel Age,
which is coming up very soon.
coming up very soon. You know, that kind of covers it as far as the first episode of Marvel Age, the stuff you guys discussed from 1961, 1962. We did it a little over an hour, but about an hour was what I was aiming for. So that's cool. I'm happy about that. This was awesome, man. I enjoyed the discussion a lot, Rosie. You know your shit. And this was a fun time for me, so I appreciate it.
I'm glad that you had me on as the first guest, Ben. That is something I always enjoy doing. Always enjoy talking to you, and very happy that you're now a regular contributor to the Place to Be Nation pup feed.
I still got to learn to say it.
We got
to
get one in. You got to say it every Place episode. Nation,
pup.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. No. That's what it is. And look, I'm so thrilled to be here. I'm so thrilled to be talking to you guys about what I love, comic books, specifically Marvel. I think, you know, I said at the beginning of the episode, like, a lot of you know, my goal here is to kind of talk about why Marvel is special, why Marvel changed the game, why they remain the leaders in the industry. And I think we talked about a lot of that stuff tonight. But I think we also, you know, we're critical. There was stuff we Absolutely. Didn't like, and there was stuff that wasn't good, and we called it on the carpet. And, you know, sometimes I'm going to agree with you guys, sometimes I'm going to disagree with you guys, but I think we gave a pretty good appraisal of the earliest Marvel work. And I hopefully this is your job to get to the other guys on Marvel Age. Get them to listen to this before you guys record your next episode. So hopefully they'll have a little context and be a little informed.
I think that'll be a really easy job.
Good, good. So I hope everyone listens. So listen, guys, I want to thank Russell Sellers for being my first guest here on Marvel's Masterclass. And I want to thank everyone who listened and who has supported it. And I want to tell you that if you want to comment on the show, if you want to interact with us, I'll tell you how to interact with me, and then Russell will tell you how to interact with him. I am very publicly at Ben J. Morse on Twitter. There is a Ben Morse on Twitter, and he stole the name from me. It's another story for another day. But I am Ben J. Morse on Twitter. That's the best way to get in touch with me. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook as well. I'm definitely going to be active on the Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page, so we'll get a thread going there for Masterclass. And, you know, hopefully we can do some fan interaction in future episodes. But definitely you guys reach out. I want to talk to you. I want to hear what you thought of the first episode. So, Russell, how can people get in touch with you?
Guys, you can hit me up at Russell_Sellers on Twitter. Send all sorts of angry messages about how I don't know what I'm talking about Hulk or Ant-Man. I'd love to hear from the Hulk and Ant-Man fans.
I would love to hear that too. I would love to hear from the Ant-Man fans in particular.
Yes, hit up all the places that Ben just talked about, and definitely check out Marvel Age podcast if you've got 3 hours or better to commit to it.
Yeah, if you've got 3 hours to spare.
But hey, we're a monthly show, so we want to give you a bulk of content to get you through your month.
Honestly, though, and this is serious, like, guys, I endorse the Marvel Age podcast, and if you, like, you're not going to listen to it all in one sitting. That would be insane.
You're
but
a trooper if you do.
It's a great podcast to listen to in segments. You know, when you have some free time, when you're doing something that you want to have a background for, put on Marvel Age and work your way through it. It's worth giving the time to.
Absolutely, and we appreciate anybody who gives this show a shot. Also, very happy that Ben has decided to be part of the Marvel Age family, and we are going to keep this going just as long as we possibly can. This is a long-form journey, so strap in, folks. We got a long way to go.
I like to think of myself as the cool uncle who buys you guys beer and cigarettes of
right?
the Marvel Age family. I think that's going to be my role. Anyways, we've talked enough. Hopefully you guys have enjoyed the first episode of Marvel Masterclass. We'll be back talking 1963 in the near future. One thing I'm not going to do is Nick like started rifling off like, here's your first guess, here's your second guess, here's your third guess. No, I'm not going to tell you who the next guest is. You have to listen to find out who's going to be on the show. That's marketing, guys. That's what I teach at UNLV. I teach marketing, public relations, and social media. If you're a UNLV student, please take one of my classes. Thanks to Russell for being on the show. Thanks to everybody for listening. Class dismissed.
promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the Pro Wrestling Only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place for Nations, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceForNation.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place for Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcasts, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talking Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows, plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows, plus others, available at PlaceForNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceForNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceForNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.